100 years ago, most shoes were manufactured by one U.S. company, the Endicott Johnson Corporation, headquartered in upstate New York. It was the largest shoe factory in the world, turning out 52 million pairs of shoes a year. It supplied boots to the U.S. Army in both world wars. But Endicott Johnson wasn't only famous for its shoes. It was also famous for having some of the best wages and the best working conditions in the U.S. The president of the company, George F. Johnson, was the first in the shoe business to introduce an 8-hour workday. He built libraries, parks, even hospitals, and offered his workers free medical care. Every baby born to an employee got a bank book with a $10 deposit and a pair of shoes. Some people called it welfare capitalism. Johnson had a different name for it. On today's show, The Square Deal.
My name is Sal Poliziano, and I worked for the Endicott Johnson Corporation for close to 40 years. When I first came up here, I looked around. I said, well, look at this. People are so friendly, and they sit on their porches, and they're listening to band concerts, and they greet me, you know. And, hello, how you doing, son? Everything was camaraderie stuff up here. And everything evolved around this George F. Johnson man. Everything was George F., George F., George F. I'm wondering, who in the world is this man? Who is he?
Noted throughout his brilliant career for his progressive policies, which have been applied particularly to improving working conditions, Mr. Johnson is deservedly called a great humanitarian.
I want you to understand, everything you have done has made everything that I have done possible.
George F. Johnson, he was one of the earliest and largest promoters of welfare capitalism. My name is Melvin Dubofsky. I'm a retired professor of history at the State University of New York. Johnson believed that it was the responsibility of the modern, progressive, up-to-date employer to provide for the workers' welfare. He offered a bargain to his employees, the concept of the square deal.
Now, what we have here, any new employee received a copy of this pamphlet called An EJ Worker's First Lesson in the Square Deal. To the new EJ worker, if you are faithful, loyal, and reliable, you will earn a good living under fair conditions. You are indeed a part
of
the company.
You are indeed a part of the company. Remember that you are cared for when sick. Medical and hospital service is yours. Privileges of many kinds are yours. Your friend, George F. Johnson.
My name is Gerald Zahavi, and I wrote a book about George F. Johnson titled Workers, Managers, and Welfare Capitalism.
Johnson's idea was, if he provided the employees with what he thought they wanted, they would be loyal, and they would show that loyalty. And with less labor turnover, he could outproduce and undersell competitors. And for a lot of working people, it was a remarkably good deal.
The first job that I had was, of course, you got to start at the bottom, and it was on a freight gang. All of a sudden, I was part of the family, and they would take care of you.
The company provided shoes for the children, health care.
Their medical plan was the most extensive in the country.
The company had its own housing corporation that built homes, financed them.
And they were very cheap, $2,200, $2,500. And if you wanted a garage, another $400, $500 for a garage.
Johnson provided playgrounds, parks, a golf course, theater.
Swimming pools, merry-go-rounds. Well, you can go down and ride the merry-go-round as many times as you want.
I'm Sandra Scanlon, and I'm the granddaughter of George F. Johnson. Grandpa had built 6 carousels in the area. When he was a little boy, he went to the fair, and he didn't have a nickel or a dime to get in to the carousel. And he never forgot that. And so he made all the ones here free. It was written into the law. They were not allowed to charge. And to this day, you ride free.
George F. Johnson, he liked to think of himself as the father of the community.
They would have these concerts on Sunday evenings, and the final song would be marching along together. And Endicott Johnson workers and managers took this as sort of an anthem.
People were singing it on the way home. Marching along together. Da-da-da-da-da-da.
There is an opposite side, an opposite side of the coin. My name is Bob Johnston, and my concept of it was that all of the benefits, this is a way to make people feel as though they had to be grateful to their leaders, the Johnson family. And I felt that this was wrong. The workers worked hard. We shouldn't have to be grateful to somebody for whom we work, for whom we're making money for them.
It was hard work. They were paid, not by the hour, but by the piece. And the worst work was in the tanneries.
Grandpa said, come with me. I want you to see this. I went into the tannery with him, and they had these great big huge vats of acid that stripped the hair off the hides. And these men with huge, huge wooden paddles stirring it with arms on them like fighters. So I'm right behind him, and the stench was horrible. I held my nose, and he turned around and saw me. Young lady, you take your fingers right down from your nose. That's your bread and butter.
America in 1932, the land of lost homes and shattered dreams. Millions of Americans homeless, hungry, and without hope.
When you come to the Depression and the company falls on hard times, Johnson and the company, they have to begin to cut wages.
About 30 years ago, I interviewed around 80 or 90 workers about life and labor at Endicott Johnson, and I still have those old recordings.
During the Depression, our work went down to, well, 3 half-days a week, 3 days a week, and it was really rough times.
There was one time I brought home a check for 13 cents. That was my pay for that week.
I remember George F. Johnson coming into the factory and making a speech one time. Well, he says, times are tough. We're not going to lay nobody off. We're all going to take what little we got. And there's lots of dandelions on the hills and fish in the rivers, so we'll have to, I guess, live on that for a while.
At the end of the 1930s, the company was threatened with a union organizing committee.
There was a strike by workers, and George F. Johnson went and tried to talk to them.
We was out there in the street fighting for more money, and he went down and he parked his car in the parking lot, and he tried to talk to us on a loudspeaker. And I'll never forget, there was tears in his eyes. He drove away in tears.
He kept preaching, you don't need a union. They can't give you anything better than what I'm giving you.
Johnson tried to ferret out union organizers from the company, alleging they were subversives.
He employs private detectives, the Pinkertons, to spy on his own workers to find out what conversations are going on in local taverns and bars behind his back. He's getting paranoid.
So the day come for election. What a day that was, though. Oh, boy.
A vote was scheduled for early January of 1940. With over 15,000 workers casting a vote for a union or against a union.
The workers were all given the time off to go and vote, and they went over there to vote with full intention to vote the union in. They went in and voted them out. That's what happened.
When push came to shove, 80% of the workers voted against the union. They did enough. They held on to enough of the square deal to hold on to the loyalty of the workers.
And when the remainder of the country was boiling over with strikes, riots, labor violence, Johnson could proudly say, it doesn't happen here.
Mr. George F. Johnson will now say a few words.
We have proven in this valley that it's possible that labor and capital may live in peace and in harmony. And I hope that great good will come from this demonstration. I thank you.
In the 1940s, Endicott Johnson grew dramatically. In World War II, the company was one of the largest providers of shoes to the U.S. military, and at its height, it employed something like 24,000 workers. Ironically, as the economic health of the company was improving, the health of its patriarch, George F. Johnson, was deteriorating.
New York Times, 1948, Endicott, New York. George F. Johnson, chairman of the board of the Endicott Johnson Corporation, died today here at his home.
The passing of George F. Johnson was stirred up in the mind.
The funeral was held, you know, at the stadium. The place was just packed with people, thousands and thousands of people. And you could have heard a pin drop.
1948 probably represented the last peak for the company. And from 1948 on, the story essentially is one of decline.
You have to remember that by the end of the 20th century, a good 70% of shoe production was in China. So that was the real challenge, is foreign imports.
All of a sudden, they were bringing in this vice president and this new president. You know, we're not making any money on that. Let's shut that department. And then you've got people saying, now, wait a minute. It wasn't like that when George F. was here.
I think the square deal is an anachronism today. Now, I don't think that workers expect very much from corporations, period.
My father-in-law worked for Endicott Johnson. My sister. I have nieces and nephews. All my children worked there. Uncle, aunts. If I could just close my eyes, I could just picture the whole thing in front of me.
Marching along together.
It's changed. I notice the merry-go-round is still there. But nobody uses it. As I go by, I just see it going around and around and around and around, like something out of the past.
Marching along together, the Endicott Johnson Workers Band.
That is a beautiful song, you know.
Yeah. Next week will be better.
In 1995, the Endicott Johnson Company was bought by U.S. Industries, and its operations were moved to Tennessee. 5 years later, it was sold to Citicorp Venture Capital. It's now owned by Rocky Brands, based in Ohio. Sal Poliziano, who you heard in this story, recently passed away at the age of 89. Sal loved working in the shoe factory, but in another life, he could have made a pretty good radio producer.
I think my background music should be the Endicott Johnson Band, like they're playing behind me. And I think that would be more effective. Of course, it wouldn't have to be to drown me out. But it's like me singing with a 70-piece orchestra. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice, me talking away? Why can't we use that as background music? Can anybody say?
The Square Deal was produced by Samara Freemark and myself with help from John Miller of Homelands Productions and edited by Deborah George and Ben Shapiro.